Call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today's February the 11th, a couple of minutes after 9 a.m. Please silence your cell phones. Present today, Senator Stedman, Senator Olson, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, and myself, Senator Hoffman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Today's agenda, we have four items on the agenda today. Shouldn't take too long. We have the first item is Senate Bill 213, the operating budget, Senate Bill 215, the mental health budget, explanation of the veto of repealed appropriations by alleged legal, and the presentation of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, which is probably the most important item on the agenda. So the first item, adoption of CS0 for Senate Bill 213, Appropriations Operating Budget Amendments and Supplementals. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Finance Committee adopt the committee substitute for Senate Bill 213 Finance, 34-GS2249-8/N, before the committee as our working document.
And I'll object for an explanation and invite Pete Eklund to explain the CS. Mr. Eklund.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. For the record, my name is Pete Eklund, staff to Senator Hoffman and the Senate Finance Committee. The committee substitute you have in front of you, Mr. Chairman, is what we refer to as CS0. It is simply put into the format of ledge legal and ledge finance, technical and conforming changes. The substance is the same as the governor's introduced budget, with one exception this year, Mr. Chairman. We do have a unique situation where the governor has introduced a Department of Agriculture. There is ongoing litigation, as you are aware. There was an executive order issued during the last special session to create the Department of Agriculture. The legislature filed suit about that and disputed whether that was a legal creation. So far, in the lower courts, they have ruled in favor of the legislature. And so for the purposes of this committee substitute, we have rolled in the Department of Agriculture back into, as a division, into the Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you for that explanation. I remove my objection. Is there any further objection to adopting the CS, referred to CS0 for Senate Bill 213? Seeing none, that motion is adopted. We'll go to the second item on the agenda. Again, this is CS0 for Senate Bill 215, the appropriations for the mental health budget. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Finance Committee adopt the committee substitute for Senate Bill 215, Finance, 34-GS252, that's 2502/N, before the committee as our working document.
And I will object for explanation from Mr. Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I guess for brevity, I'll just say ditto on this committee substitute, technical and conforming changes.
And I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection to the adoption of the CS? Seeing none, that CS is adopted. The third item is the veto of repeal appropriations. I invite Marie Marks from Ledge Council, legislative legal, to come to the table, and Emily Newman, the director of legislative legal services, and Megan Wallace, the chief counsel, is online. Please introduce yourself and give us the explanation.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Emily Newman, director of legislative legal services, and with me I have Marie.
Good morning. Good to see you all in person. As many of you know, my name is Marie Marks, and I'm legislative counsel with Legislative Legal Services. I draft in a few different areas. You probably recognize me or my name on things. And one of those areas is the language sections of the operating budget. One of the services that Legislative Legal Services offers to you, the legislature, is we just identify issues and concerns to help the legislature make informed decisions. My memorandum, dated January 21st, 2026, outlines a legal issue relating to last year's operating budget, HB 53. I plan today just to give a short summary of the question and the discussion in the memo, and then I'm happy to take any questions the members may have. Just a short, brief summary is Article 2, Section 15 of the Alaska Constitution grants the governor the power by veto to strike or reduce items in appropriation bills. And we generally refer to this as the governor's light item veto power. In last year's operating budget, the legislature reduced three previously enacted appropriations. The governor subsequently vetoed language repealing these appropriations. The issue here is whether that line item veto power in the Alaska Constitution grants the governor the power to use that veto power in a way that has the effect of increasing an amount reduced by the legislature. This issue has not been squarely addressed by the Alaska Supreme Court. However, in the case of Alaska Legislative Council v. Knowles, the Alaska Supreme Court did address what is a line item veto and what does the governor's line item veto power encompass. And the court interpreted the phrase strike or reduce as follows. Reducing an item lessens an amount and striking it lessens it to nothing. It explains the terms, those two terms, strike and reduce, have equivalent effects. They diminish the amount appropriated. Here, as you know, the governor's action in striking a repeal of a previously enacted appropriation does not reduce the amount of the appropriation to nothing or otherwise diminish the amount. It actually has the effect of increasing the amount of the appropriation. That's really a quick summary of the issue in my discussion, but I'm happy to take any questions.
Do members have questions of the discussion on the table? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Ms. Marks, if memory serves, the courts have defined item in this context. Can you remind me what an item is?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, correct, in the Knowles case, the court said an appropriation item is a sum of money dedicated to a particular purpose.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as I read your memo, it seemed to me that there's a court case that said, it's clear what reduce an item is, but the court said to strike an item isn't simply to eliminate it from the bill, it is to reduce the money. Could you help with that, the difference between just taking away our addressing of a bit of money for a purpose versus reducing the spend?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, in the Knowles case that I discuss in my memorandum, the court interpreted what is strike, and it specifically said it is quantitatively or qualitatively the same as reduce. It diminishes an amount appropriated. And specifically, the court said strike is to reduce an amount to nothing.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So then for the argument that's out there, there's an argument out there that strike simply means to take it out of the bill. For the court to agree with that, it would have to explicitly overrule its prior ruling. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I think that issue was not directly on point in that Knowles case. It was talking about whether the governor can strike language that doesn't appropriate a sum of money for a particular purpose. In that case, the governor had appropriated money relating to positions or extraneous money that is not a sum of money, or extraneous language that's not a sum of money for a particular purpose. So I think the argument would be, did it directly address striking a veto of repeal? in that sense, the court would not necessarily, I think, have to overrule itself. It could clarify. The court could clarify its ruling in Knowles, but you're absolutely correct that the court, I think, would have to address this language in Knowles that explicitly stated striking is reducing an amount to nothing. It would have to clarify that.
Just one last, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Keel.
At one point in your memo, and I apologize, skimming while I listen isn't my strongest suit, there was a reference to someone saying that the line item veto power exists only to close the purse strings. Who was that?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that was in the same Knowles case that explained what does the power that governor have under the line item veto power grounded in the Constitution, and it was only to tighten the state's purse strings. It cannot loosen them.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That sounds like more than a clarification to go the other way.
So the decision is before the legislature. Whether we go forward or not, it remains to be seen. I just wanted to have this on the table so that members and the general public understand where we are. Any further questions before I set this aside? Thank you very much for that explanation. We'll set this aside and go to the last item on our agenda, which is the Permanent Fund Corporation. I invite Devin Mitchell, the Chief Executive Officer and Executive Director, and Marcus Frantum, the Chief Investment Officer, to the table to give us a presentation on the Permanent Fund Corporation, our crown jewel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Devin Mitchell, I'm the CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, and as you stated, I have with me today our Chief Investment Officer, Marcus Frampton. We have a slide deck to update you on. Some of the things are going to be reminders because we have some of the same slides we share every year, but obviously beneficial to your wider audience. And then some specifics related to the corporation's performance over the course of the last year and historically prior to that. So this is the 50th anniversary of the fund's creation by the Alaska legislature. The statute was passed in a legislative session 50 years ago that provided for the joint resolution for the constitutional amendment that was approved in the fall or the summer of 1976. And so we're in the process of celebrating that. We had 75,000 people back at that point that sacrificed the ability to have a resource rebate for themselves and instead decided to save money for the future of the state of Alaska and that intergenerational concept that we have finite resources that we're developing as a resource-oriented state for the benefit of the residents of the state after those resources are depleted as one-time use resources. And certainly that's something to celebrate, that 75,000 in the electorate of the day represented 66 or 67% of the voters of the state, so as much of a landslide as you could have in an election generally. So an incredible act of thinking beyond oneself that occurred that we're benefiting from today. The constitutional amendment that was approved was pretty simple. All it said is we're going to save money, we're going to invest money, and then we're going to spend all the money unless we're otherwise directed by the state's statutes to do otherwise, the legislature. And so that was the debate in 1976, and then the corporation and the Permanent Fund Dividend Program were created subsequent to that in 1980, and then ultimately the program that wound up paying money in 1982 and the first Permanent Fund Dividend Distribution. On slide 3, we show some of the history of the fund's development. You can see that initial deposit in 1978 of $780,000 that's grown to a balance at the point of this financial reporting of about $86 billion. And a portion of that, of course, is in the earnings reserve account that's spendable, appropriatable by 51% vote of the legislature and concurrence of the governor, and the balance is in principle. This slide's a little, there's not as much clarity in here as there could be because a portion of the balance of the fund is actually unrealized income that we'll delve into later in CIO Frampton's slides that isn't categorically earnings reserve account or principal. It's, I'll call it a gray area in between the two, and it is allocated between the two accounts while it's unrealized, and if it's in fact realized when those investments are sold, then it shifts over to the earnings reserve account. But in the meantime, it somewhat overstates both the ERA balance as well as the principal balance. The actual constitutional principal balance is less than the amount you would see on this chart. It's actually $59.8 billion rather than, you know, the 70-some billion that's reflected on this chart. So just something to be aware of. So $73.8 billion is reflected in here as the ERA balance, and the principal balance in 12.5 is the ERA balance, but you would have lesser balances in the principal if those earnings were realized, and greater balance in the ERA if, again, those are realized, those unrealized earnings.
Can you inform the committee and the general public what year did the legislature first spend funds out of the earnings reserve account?
It would have been, through the chair, Mr. Chair, it would have been 1983. The first permanent fund dividend was funded out of the general fund, the $1,000 distribution, so that would have been the first year of a permanent fund dividend funded from the permanent fund, would have been 1983. In 2018, the formula for determining draws from the dividend was shifted from a historical percentage of earnings draw to a percent of market value draw in statute. Both of those things are obviously still in statute, but the state's been following the percent of market value draw, a historical average balance of the last 5 years, taking a percentage of that. Initially, it was a higher percentage. It's now a 5% percentage, and we've been using that methodology since 2019, and that was also the point that the permanent fund was used for more than just permanent fund dividends. It was also used for support of other governmental operational needs.
And that was Senate Bill 16 that came from the Senate Finance Committee, was sponsored by the Senate Finance Committee. Please proceed.
Thank you. One important thing on this slide that when you're talking about things that the legislature did, that kind of brownish line that goes across that winds up around $20 billion, that's how much money would be in the permanent fund today if there wasn't a statutory framework that provided for the earnings to be retained in the fund through special appropriations. And special appropriations have occurred from both the general fund as well as the earnings reserve account, as well as the inflation-proofing appropriations that have been made regularly by the legislature to the principal of the fund. So a financial resource, again, that's been built on the structure and the discipline of past generations of Alaskans. So the permanent fund invests more than just, or the permanent fund corporation invests more than just the permanent fund. We also invest the mental health trust fund's money. I think you had a presentation earlier this week related to that, as well as the power cost equalization endowment. And so those total about $1.8 billion that's part of the assets under management that the fund's currently managing. And if you just looked at AUM, assets under management, we're actually over $91 billion that's being managed by the corporation today. So that would include this 1.8 as well as liability, money that we're going to pay to the state this fiscal year. So it's not counted as part of our financial net worth at this point because we have an offsetting liability, but we're still managing that money until it's needed by the state of Alaska, pay it over through the plan that's developed by the Department of Revenue and Treasury Division. The Amerita Hess settlement money is a subcategory of the permanent fund. It is principal of the permanent fund that can't be spent, but the earnings are used in a different fashion from other earnings of the fund. This settlement, based on the fact that the jury was, it was an oil and gas litigation settlement, that the jury was comprised of Alaskans, and there was a fear from the defense that the Alaskans on the jury would be compromised by the knowledge that any deposit from the settlement would go into the permanent fund and affect their dividends, so they had a conflict. And so to avoid that potential of conflict, the Amerita Hess settlement was directed by the court not to be incorporated into any calculation of the permanent fund dividends, so the historical 21% of the last 5 years' earnings calculation, and has maintained that status and is still held separately within the principal of the permanent fund. We have a board of trustees, six-member board of trustees, four from the general public appointed by the governor on staggered four-year terms, as well as two from the executive branch, one of which must be the commissioner of the Department of Revenue, and one other member of the cabinet. And everyone at the permanent fund works every day to, in their role, maximize the risk-adjusted rate of return of the permanent fund for the residents of Alaskans. It's something that every person, I believe, that comes to work at the corporation has an opportunity to embrace that mission, because it's something everybody can be proud of that works there. And it is, I think, part of a culture that drives us to success. And at the same time, we want to be accountable to you and every other Alaskan in that effort.
Senator Stedman.
Can we go back to that slide, please? The power cost equalization, is there any creative way we could roll that into the constitutional protection so it can't get looted?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I mean, this is outside my, maybe you would ask your attorney, but based on my experience in the Department of Revenue, knowledge of the state of Alaska's constitution that has prohibitions on dedications of state revenue, unless there's some carve out, which there may be for the mental health trust, but so there would be a legal analysis that would need to occur. If there's not an ability to dedicate that revenue already, then there would need to be some modification to provide for it, which would, of course, require a constitutional amendment.
Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, I think maybe we should ask that question. I think it's probably not able to do it, but if there's some creative way we can get the power cost equalization endowment protected from overdraws, we should definitely seriously consider that.
We should. Thank you, Senator Stedman. Mitchell.
Thank you. Slide 6 demonstrates the success of the permanent fund in replacing finite resource revenue with infinite investment income from not just concentrated investment or economy in the state of Alaska, but the world economy. So we have investments around the world, primarily in the United States, but around the world, that all of those investments return, come back to the state of Alaska to benefit us in our state. And so we have, at this point, in my view, the most diversified revenue stream of any state in the United States that's predicated upon the permanent funds investment around the world, relative to a reliance on our local economy for income to support our state's needs. The asset allocation has evolved over the years. We started off and kind of dipped our toe in the water, and everybody was very conservative at that point in time. The 1970s were it was after inflation, a negative performance year for the S&P 500, and so the idea of taking additional risk wasn't in the forefront of folks' minds. All fixed income when the fund was initially invested, and then gradually as the fund matured and the structures matured surrounding the corporation and the ability to perform as an institutional investment house, additional asset classes added initially with real estate and public equities, and then absolute return, private equity, and then we have the eight asset classes we currently have, which is intended to, this asset class is equivalent to an 80% equity, 20% fixed income portfolio. It just has greater diversity within it so that we have an expectation of lesser volatility. Risk equals volatility. So risk equals uncertainty and greater wins and greater losses. We're going to be a little bit closer to the middle, but we expect over the long term to have outperformance as a result of this asset allocation or portfolio construction relative to just an 80-20 portfolio construction. And Marcus can talk more about that if you have questions. This slide shows the historical earnings rate of the fund, and we talk a lot about the return objectives of the fund, and we have multiple return objectives, but maybe the most important or arguably is the CPI plus 5. So we want to earn a real rate of return, a rate of return after inflation of 5%. And this chart looks at five-year historical bands of time, and the gold dot reflects the target of CPI plus 5 over that 10-year lifespan of the fund, and the blue represents the real rate of return or the rate of return after inflation, and the gray represents inflation, and if you add those together, that's the return that was achieved for each one of those segments. Interestingly, if you look at this same chart with a five-year look back, there's more volatility, predictably more volatility to it, and so you see in the years leading up to the global financial crisis, outperformance above the gold dot, and then it goes negative. The real return goes negative for a couple of years afterwards, which is informative when you consider what happens when you look at shorter time frames rather than longer time frames. And again, when you consider is a 5% draw rate an appropriate draw rate for an institutionally invested fund like the permanent fund. And this chart suggests that it's a not to exceed amount in many ways. If we actually had a draw back in like 2009, for example, I asked the question the other day, and the draw based on the historical earnings formula was like 2.85%. In a year that we had a loss of close to, it was in the high teens. So we had a loss in the high teens, and we were paying out 2.85% for just permanent fund dividends at the time, of course. And so if you said, what if you'd used that formula where you used the other half for state services? So this, if you recall, the formula says half goes to the permanent fund dividend account and half goes to the state of Alaska under the old statute, that there would have been a draw during a year that you had high teens negative performance of almost 6%. And so it's very difficult as you contemplate the potential of negative markets and the long-term stability needs of the state of Alaska with this fund to not consider how we're investing the money and how we're taking risk and how we're going to draw money from the fund. And those are all difficult questions to answer with a lot of nuance to them, but certainly are issues that the committee should be thinking about and aware of.
Senator Stedman.
If he's done with this slide, I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Yesterday we had a presentation from Alaska Mental Health, and they had changed their payout rate. They raised it from, I think, 4.25 to 4.5, and we asked them about that, and they said that their consultant, Callan, recommended that they move up to 4.5 to get that balance between current demands of the beneficiaries of the Alaska Mental Health and future demands on the mental health members or what have you. And I'm just kind of curious, you know, if that sweet spot between current and future is 4.5 for mental health, why isn't it 4.5 for the permanent fund? Because they're both in perpetuity, both have draws every year. There is a concern that at 5% draw, it's pretty much at the top of the range for the permanent fund of the draw rate. It doesn't seem to be a lot of cushion there. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that, because I was surprised yesterday when Alaska Mental Health moved their payout rate to 4.5.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, yes, that's there's statistical probabilities based on historical markets and your asset allocation as to whether or not you break your mold, your model, based on a draw rate. And so the lower the draw rate, the higher your statistical probability of not breaking the model. It's kind of common sense, right? And so at a 4.5, our chief risk officer has done analysis that he gains confidence as you get into that 4.5 range that you would have high probabilities of not breaking the model. And so Callan in their modeling, as they're also our general market consultant, there's a lot of variables that go into any model, and in particular in this scenario. And so you have to take it under consideration that at the point in time that the POMB was created for the state of Alaska, the needs of the state were dire. There was a lot of need. The draw rate initially was higher than 5%. It was I can't remember, was it 5.5 or 5.25? Maybe 5.5 one year, then 5.25 for a couple of years.
Yes, that was set.
And then it
the interest rate
to
was
five.
Set in Senate Bill 26.
Yes, and so there was established like kind of a stair step down to 5%, and I think a lot of that was driven by just the pure necessity of the day, right? And so it's difficult. And if you look, in my time at the fund, there have been discussions at board meetings about the draw rate, and our advisors have consistently we have external board advisors, three folks that have specific financial expertise that advise the board, and they've uniformly suggested that 5% is either the maximum or too high. Callan is a little bit more squishy. I think that they haven't maybe been as forceful, but I think if you looked at our meeting of December 2023, that I believe they were saying that 5% was a maximum and shouldn't be exceeded and perhaps too high. If you look at other sovereign wealth funds around the world, it's challenging to find one that has a 5% draw rate. And so you see a lot of 3 to 4% range, which arguably is too low. And so it is. It's like this challenge of how do you take into consideration the needs of the current generation of Alaskans at the same time you consider the needs of the future state of Alaska and generations of Alaskans that are going to live here, and balance those two kind of conflicting needs.
And the difference between the mental health trust, they have the authority to set their draw rate, and the draw rate for the permanent fund and for power cost equalization are set by law?
Yes, I believe so, Mr. Chair.
So if we want to change the draw rate for the permanent fund to something lower, such as the board, mental health board did, we'd have to introduce legislation to do so. Thank you, Senator Stedman. Further comments?
Yeah, just one comment. I think if we consider that, we could also consider a step down from 5 to 4.5 if somebody's contemplating that. And I guess it comes down to, you know, how much from a particular viewpoint you want to put on future generations of Alaska versus current generations of Alaska, how much you want to try to take care of your grandchildren and great grandchildren that aren't even here yet versus the immediate needs of making the ends meet in this current budget cycle.
Senator Stedman, are you considering recommending to the committee that we introduce legislation on a step down?
I would, Mr. Chairman, I would like the members of the committee to think about that for a little bit and maybe have some conversations and see if there's support at the committee to have that policy and discussion at the table. And if there is, there is. And if there's not, there's not. But I am personally inclined to follow along with the Alaska Mental Health proposal. I think that made a lot of sense. And I recognize that once you have a draw rate to the general fund, it's like a heroin addict. You know, it's hard to get off of that draw rate. And if it was 6 or 6.5 or 5, whatever it is, you know, it's tough to do. But we can do it over time if to make it easier on the folks that have to deal with the operating budget, mainly, Mr. Chairman, yourself.
So members of the committee should consider this, and we may consider introducing legislation as a committee if that is the desire of the members. Senator Keel.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Maybe the folks from the Permanent Fund could help inform the discussion a little. It looks, as I look at this chart, like we've done just fine since 2010, maybe 2009. Do we just have sort of negative Nelly sitting to the right of me who contemplates your future failure, or do you guys have it figured out?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. No, that's negative Nelly sitting to my right. But I think what this chart shows, and you have to remember that during this time frame, there wasn't a POMB draw. There was a permanent fund dividend draw. So you had a lesser use of the fund. And the most critical thing about the time frame that you have negative market experience is, well, fiscal discipline and ability to leave your investment intact. So if you're putting money in the S&P 500 and never drawing it, then that's hard to argue with. But when you start using it actively every year, it changes the math, because when there's a correction and a loss in value, and then you have a draw of a fixed percentage of a higher value, that percentage just became higher, right? So you're not drawing 5, now you're drawing 6 or 8. And when the market recovers, that money's not there to recover and buoy the results afterwards. And so if you look at those time frames, our ability to withstand those negative markets was buoyed by the lesser use of the fund at the time. So I'm not sure that the historic, what you were saying, like a historical example, is necessarily the same fact set that you would see on that chart if the draw rate we have today was in place back in that time frame.
So, Mr. Chairman,
McKeel.
So just to make sure I'm clear on that, right, this isn't dollars. This is return percentages.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that's correct. The percentages would change.
Okay.
Because you wouldn't have the money to invest anymore. It would have been spent. So if you had a fixed 5% historical average draw in 2009, that example I used where I said, oh, there was a 2.85% distributed for dividends, well, you would have taken that historical balance and it would have been 5% of that, not 2.85%. So you would have taken more money out of the fund, and then when the markets started recovering immediately after 2009, that money wouldn't have been there, and so your performance and ability to build back wouldn't have been in place.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Please proceed.
For the record, my name is Marcus Frampton. I'm the Chief Investment Officer of the Alaska Permanent Fund. I just have one comment on this page. Just from a historical standpoint, I started at the fund in 2012, and we had just come out of the global financial crisis. And as you see on this chart, at that point, it had been about 3 years since, on a 10-year basis, we had achieve the CPI plus 5, and then markets recovered, and 6 years into that time, in 2018, we first hit the point where, on a 10-year look back, we were hitting the inflation plus 5 return objective of the fund. And I don't think that's more a reflection of where the markets were than how the investment decisions were being done at the time. And every year, we set an asset allocation that's intended to have roughly a 50% chance of hitting inflation plus 5 over the next 10 years. So we look at expected returns, and we understand there are bull markets and there are bear markets, and it's roughly 50-50 that it'll be inflation plus 5 outcome with that asset allocation. If you look at the decade ended 2009, that was a very difficult decade with the dot-com bust and then the global financial crisis. We had a modest positive real return on the fund. The S&P 500 had a negative real return. And so, like, that was a period where diversification really helped. The last 15 years, more concentrated, large U.S. stock portfolios have done better. A 5% POMV draw with an S&P 500 portfolio in the decade ended 2009 would be crippling. You would be under, you'd lose, with drawing 5% of the fund with no real return for a decade would erode half the value of the fund on a nominal basis, and then when you layer in inflation would erode another 20% of the fund. You'd be left with about a third of the real value of the fund by the end of the decade if you got into a difficult U.S. stock market environment like that with a concentrated U.S. portfolio. You'd have a similar outcome in the 1970s, negative real return on the S&P 500, similar outcome in the 1940s, the Great Depression, negative real return on the S&P 500. And they may seem like isolated impacts, but those are three out of the last 10 decades. So you have like a 30% chance of a crippling outcome with a concentrated S&P 500 portfolio.
Some of the larger decisions that affect the fund itself are the amount of the payout for the permanent fund dividend that is fluctuate, and we have not followed that law and have used that as sort of a buffer. And the other major factor is whether or not we inflation-proof it or not inflation-proof the fund. And those would have big swings on the fund, but those decisions are made by the legislature.
Mr. Mitchell.
Please proceed.
One thing I wanted to do today was do a review of the performance of the fund. And to do that, there's three measures that get assessed. And they tell us different things. So we've just talked about the fund's performance against the CPI plus 5 return objective. That's the bottom number, so I'll kind of start on this page and go up. If we look at the five-year basis, that is the toughest period against inflation plus 5 on this 1, 3, 5, 10, 42-year framework. So on a five-year basis, it's one of those periods that around half the time that metric's not achieved. But the good news is that on the longer-term basis, 10 years, and then 42 years, is, the fund's older than 42 years old, but that was when Cowen started doing performance reporting for us, so that's when we've got good numbers to look at. The fund has achieved actually CPI plus 6, effectively. I'm going to go into later how we make decisions on asset allocation, but from a day-to-day investment standpoint, we don't manage to inflation plus 5. If there was an instrument, a financial instrument that gave you inflation plus 5, we'd consider buying that. But if you want to lock in an inflation plus return, you'd have to buy a Treasury inflation protected security, and that's giving you kind of inflation plus 1.5 or 2 right now. So by necessity, we invest in risk assets across six major asset classes. The largest is public equities, the second is fixed income. Then we have our private asset classes, private equity, real estate, private income, which is infrastructure and private credit. We have a hedge fund portfolio. The performance benchmark is what we manage to on a day-to-day basis. So after we do the asset allocation, and conclude, the board concludes with staff input that we're going to do 30% global stocks, the performance benchmark then sets 32% of that calculation is how did global stocks do. Fixed income is 20%. So 20% of the performance benchmark is the composite of investment grade institutional fixed income. And our team gets assigned these benchmarks and they manage against them. And they accumulate up on a percentage basis on how assets are allocated. So day to day, we're looking at, in terms of execution, are we in the right real estate properties? Are we in the right bonds and stocks? It's the portfolio against this performance benchmark. And similar to the return objective, it's not a situation where every year we beat the performance benchmark. It's more than the 50% of the time that's the return objective, but it's certainly well under 100% of the time. When you look at these numbers, where the biggest pressure we've had, you see the slight underperformance fiscal year to date and the 3 year, the biggest driver, the majority of that, is an underweight in our stock portfolio to software and technology companies. And that has been well covered in the financial press, the big, they call them Mag 7 tech companies, and then the next level down software companies have been the market leaders for the last 5 years. And they are trading at very extended valuations now. That's been a major headwind. I'm pleased that in spite of that, we're still beating our benchmark on 1 year and 5 year. The 3 year is the toughest period. We've actually started seeing this calendar year a real sell-off in software companies under threat from AI, and the AI companies that are threatening the software companies tend to be private companies, so we're not underweight the AI companies that are threatening the software companies, and we are very much underweight the companies that are under pressure as this calendar year has started. So through today, we're beating fiscal year to date. If this keeps up, we'll trend back positive over the 3 year. But on balance, I would say we're trying to manage the portfolio conservatively given the exuberant market. We're holding a little extra cash, and we're underweight the very expensive stocks, which has led to this mixed performance on the 3 year and the fiscal year to date. Another thing I just wanted to mention is something that Devin mentioned, is that we are a very performance-oriented firm. We're it's a very competitive spirit. People are very focused on every basis point, and we're very proud of these results. When I joined 12 years ago, I think the culture was a little more, I don't even think this is a bad thing necessarily, but it was much more conservative, protect capital at all cost approach, and a little bit less let's beat benchmarks. And that does show up in these numbers. If you look at the 10-year, we're beating our benchmark by 30 basis points. But on the 42-year, we've underperformed per annum by 9 basis points. So if we're beating in the last 10 years and underperforming on the balance or for the full 42, it does imply that for the 32 years before the 10 years, the fund did underperform its benchmark. And I attribute that to like this very conservative management philosophy that was in place. And I think we still have a very conservative management philosophy in our and it's reflected in underweighting expensive stocks, holding a little more cash, but we're balancing a performance orientation a little bit better in the last 10 years. So that's the performance benchmark. I think it's a very strong record over long periods, and the way the market's turning now, turning into a very strong performance on short periods. We also have a passive benchmark, which is in the next row down. That is a benchmark that we do not manage to day to day, but stakeholders should be very attuned to because it represents what a similar diversified portfolio that could be invested in with the click of a mouse in anyone's Vanguard account. So that portfolio is 60% global equities, 20% fixed income, 10% REITs, which are real estate securities that trade, and 10% TIPS, Treasury inflation-protected securities. There's no magic to that 60-20-10-10. It's just a mix that was arrived at when that passive benchmark was created something like 15 years ago. And what we see with that passive benchmark, because it's 60% global stocks and our portfolio is 32% global stocks, is when you have big run-ups, big bull markets in the stock market, our portfolio generally can't keep up with the passive benchmark that's 60%, that is twice the stocks that we have. And if you look back over time, we commented probably half the time we outperform inflation plus 5, more than half the time we outperform the performance benchmark. The passive benchmark is much more consistent on the long term. For the whole time I've been at the Permanent Fund, if you look at like 5 and 10 year, we almost always are beating the passive benchmark because there's time for our illiquid equity investments to generate return. But on a year-to-year basis, it's basically like, what did the stock market do? If it was strong, we underperformed passive. If the stock market's weak, we beat passive. So I hope that's clear, and I didn't confuse everyone with the three different metrics, but they are very different measures and tell very different things about how the fund's performing. And if I left you with anything, it's that we're very performance-oriented and are trying to balance that with also being conservative and care tremendously about how the fund's doing, and we think the fund's doing well.
Question on this slide. Please proceed.
I'm going to skip these. I covered this. I also covered some of this on this page, but I'll just reiterate a couple points. There has been conversation about should the fund just invest in the S&P 500. That's a bad idea, and there is real value to diversification. It just hasn't shown up in the last 5 to 10 years. The S&P 500 has been an index since the late 1800s, and if you go back through the history of the S&P 500 and think about a 5% POMB, it's hard to conclude that you'd want to be 100% in it. We know a lot of different endowments and state funds. No one is 100% in the S&P 500. There's no one who has their stock portfolio 100% in the S&P 500. Every other peer organization has looked at this question and concluded that they want small cap stocks, that they want international stocks, that they don't want just the 500 biggest U.S. stocks. So we don't see it in our industry. We feel like the S&P 500 today has a lot of risk because it's concentrated in the tech sector. That concentration increases risk. And then there's also a legal point. All funds like the Permanent Fund are established with guidelines and statutes, and we have a statute that mandates diversification. And it's not to say that 100% S&P 500 portfolio would necessarily violate that statute, but we think it would likely violate it.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. I think some of the questions are maybe very narrow to just the S&P, but some of the questions I've heard are more general with respect to indexing. So if, I don't know if you had a VT or VTI for a certain piece of it, and BND as far as a couple of ETFs to just come up with a very low cost, diversified and risk balance ratio of that, maybe some REITs, real estate investment trusts. So just kind of build a passive portfolio like that, perhaps with some AI management, just trying to keep you, maintain your asset allocation over time. Just for the sake of those that wonder those things, what do you think about that type of model?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Kaufman, I think highly of that model. I think that's a good model that in particular institutions that have limited resources or, you know, Warren Buffett, everyone likes to quote Warren Buffett. He has a great quote. He says, once you acknowledge that you're dumb money, you stop being dumb money because you do exactly what you just said. I mean, in our industry, dumb money is a commonly used term for someone who doesn't have an insight in the market to validate active management. It's not pejorative necessarily, even though it sounds like it. But most people should do exactly what you're doing, like in their accounts. Probably most institutions should do that. And we don't see it that much in our industry, but even though no one does just the S&P 500, people do versions of what you just said. Like State of Nevada is the most well known for that. And they have one employee. They're active in private equity and real estate, but they outsource it. So they've hired a firm to go find private equity investments and real estate investments, and they index stocks and bonds. And it's worked really well for them. And they're a top-performing fund. They have low cost. So I always look at how we do versus them. Some years we beat them. Some years they beat us. I think what you described is a good approach to manage money. Our institution has decided to do active management, and we've built a 27-person investment team, and we have expertise in the different markets. And we don't take it as a given that we're going to be trusted to actively manage the fund. Like, if we fail to produce benchmark-beating performance, that failure should result in the Nevada model. I don't think that we've failed on those measures. And I think the analysis that's been done that argues that we have is faulty analysis. But I think that, so when I look at our passive benchmark and we've beaten it on 5 and 10, I think that validates the active management we're doing. And when we've beaten our performance benchmark on 1, 5, 10, I think that validates it. But you can't, I think I answered your question. I think I have a lot of respect for that model.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you for your answer, and I just want to add, you know, I respect the work that you're doing, so I'm not trying to chip away at that. But, folks have mentioned it, and I just thought I'd take it a little bit beyond the simple S&P argument, just for the sake of the conversation about diversification. So, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it's a good sort of thread of conversation. Folks are looking at their 401 accounts. They're seeing some pretty big numbers in the last couple of years. We're not necessarily seeing those numbers here, and you talked a little bit about that in light of the fact that we need to draw money each year. Did our predecessors mess this up? Should our predecessors not have told you to diversify the fund and your predecessors to diversify the fund until the time when we needed to start drawing from it in a more significant way?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. So don't misunderstand me. I think those are two different issues. Like the impact of having a draw during a volatile market is different than diversification within our portfolio construction. And so as far as whether or not, I think Marcus has already, I'm sorry, CIO Frampton, has already provided a lot of explanation about the history of the S&P 500 and the almost unrecoverable events that occur from time to time in that market. And the value of diversification is going to be borne out during those times. We're in a time of extraordinaryism. I don't know if you've heard that term, but it's a term used for the U.S. markets in recent times, U.S. extraordinaryism. There was kind of a shift away from that, and you saw a sign of a kind of a bounce in international markets in the last year. But otherwise, the U.S. markets have been doing extraordinarily well, and that's primarily been borne upon the the fate or the work of a small number of companies that have done extraordinarily well, the Mag 7. And if you look at the percentage of the S&P 500 that those companies represent, from a historical perspective relative to today, it's become a challenge for organizations like ours that might have a more strict diversity mandate that they can't even invest in the S&P 500 because it's too concentrated in seven companies. The diversification's gone away. If you remove those seven companies from the S&P 500, the performance is somewhat mediocre to not great. And so it's the time frame that as an individual, it has been an amazing time if you have a lot of money deployed in the S&P 500 because it has been an extraordinarily strong market. But whether or not that will continue into the future is highly questionable based on historical experience. And so it's a matter of when you look at our forefathers and mothers that created this structure that we have of diversification, I think that that's definitely a prudency issue and a fiduciary standard that you would be irresponsible. It's more like you would set yourself up for larger failures if you didn't have those constructs built into your portfolio construction. Sorry, Marcus.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, it depends on whose 401k it is. If it's a young person, they're all in stocks and they've done well, that's fantastic and they did the right thing, but they should be aware that the market can go down. If there's a person closer to retirement who's done really well in their 401k because they're all in stocks, then even though it was a good outcome, I think they made a mistake because they're exposing themselves to a lot of risk. Like the stock market today is more expensive than it was in 1929, and that could be devastating to a near retiree if they've got their 401k all in stocks.
Please proceed.
So I thought I would just comment quickly on the expected return of the fund and the asset classes and how we come up with asset allocation. So Cowen Associates, our consultant, has capital market forecasts, and those numbers on the right are the 10-year capital market forecast that Cowen has for each of the asset classes the fund is in. So they believe that private equity will return on average 8.5% per annum, global stocks 7.5%, and so on down the list to, you know, fixed income being the lowest major asset class at 4.7%, which is still a much higher return than in the past fixed incomes had when rates were lower. Down at the bottom on the right, we have Cowen's inflation forecast. So they're forecasting 2.5% inflation. So if we were just all in fixed income to reduce risk, we'd be at CPI plus 2 would be the expectation for the fund's return. When you add up our targets, which are on the left there, to their forecasts, it arrives at a before inflation return of 7.3% and a real return of 4.8%. So that's, I earlier made the comment that we build portfolios that are expected to earn CPI plus 5. Cowen would score our portfolio at CPI plus 4.8, and then we attempt to get to 5 through beating our benchmarks is the strategy, and they would assign on a probability basis roughly a 50-50 that over the next 10 years this portfolio would hit CPI plus 5. For the next portion, I'm going to spend a few minutes on how we make investment decisions and the due diligence process when we go into investments. And I hope to leave everyone with an understanding of how we make decisions and also an understanding of all the checks and balances in place and third parties that get involved to help us review investment opportunities. So at the core of our investment process is an investment committee. The investment committee meets once a week on Thursdays, and there are three parties that vote at the investment committee. So It's myself, and then we have a deputy CIO for private markets, Alan Waldrop, and a deputy CIO for public markets, Jim Parise. So to pursue an investment, it's majority vote of those three. So it hasn't happened yet, but I could be against it and the other two for it, and it would go ahead. And similarly, if I want to do something and Alan and Jim don't want to do it, it doesn't go ahead. So we meet, and then also importantly, our chief risk officer, Sebastian Batacomcheri, participates in the meetings. He reports to Devin, not to me. And he makes sure that we follow all the policies and are in compliance with our investment policy statement. We maintain a pretty open investment committee. In my career, I've been at places that have had investment committees that are pretty tight, and it's a little secretive with the partners. Ours is open. Our interns, our analysts join. Anyone can ask a question. So that's the overall process, and that committee reviews decisions on private investments, like going into an investment, exiting an investment, refinancing a real estate property, things like that. And then it also reviews like major moves on the public side. It delegates to the investment team individual stock and bond purchases, but things like what tracking error, which is a risk limit, do we want to run equities at? The investment committee will review major policy matters like that. The most intensive part of what we do on an individual investment basis are private investments that we pursue, whether it's buying a building or investing in a fund or co-investing with a private equity fund. And we have an investment process that's laid out on this page that roughly fits into four categories and spans 3 to 12 months. I won't go through every line. In fact, the font's a little small, but we review a lot of funds at the initial review stage. So like hundreds of private equity funds, hundreds of venture capital funds. In the case of private equity, we have a six-person team. So the portfolio managers and the analysts on that team are like kind of always talking to the different funds that are in the market and looking at their track record, how it fits with our portfolio, how they've done versus the managers we have. And that's the initial review. If we get interested in an opportunity, it then goes into due diligence, which is a 1 to 3 month period where there's additional meetings where we're doing more formal review of track record and performance comparisons. Usually at this stage is when we start looking at the legal terms, which are important on private funds. But at this point, it's probably been introduced to the IC, but not in detail. And if that yields a positive outcome, it goes to extensive due diligence. That's when we often bring in a third-party consultant, which would do things like background checks of principals, office visits that might not be accessible to us. Like, for example, we're investing in Asia funds and funds that we might not necessarily have an on-the-ground presence, but our consultant would have a presence. And at that point, we often bring in counsel to look at the fund documents. That's anywhere from 1 to 6 months. And then it goes to final approval. And at this point, the investment committee is well briefed on the opportunity and has heard in fair amount of detail why it's a good fit with our portfolio. And once the investment committee makes a decision, then it goes to Devin, unless he has otherwise delegated that particular matter to me. So I wanted to just, given the dollars involved and the fees we're paying and the amount we have in private investments, I wanted to, even though this is a bit of a summary, leave everyone with a sense of the level of work that we're doing when we make a private fund investment.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Digital Bridge. I think you guys have a couple of holdings with that company. And I think the process that the permanent fund goes through to select investments are different than the Department of Revenue, particularly concerning this company. Could you walk through the process of, if you know, how, what from your recollection, what Digital Bridge went through to be selected and worked in with the permanent fund. And the reason I ask that, Mr. Chairman, at some point we'll have the Department of Revenue here, and we can compare and contrast the management process between those two entities dealing with the same company. Can you help me with that?
Through the chair, Senator Steadman, yes, we have two investments with Digital Bridge, and they're in our private infrastructure portfolio. In any given year, we deploy roughly $500 million into private infrastructure opportunities, and the team follows all the major infrastructure funds, and Digital Bridge is one of them. And I don't have the exact date, but their most recent fund was in the last, call it, 18 months, and their predecessor fund was probably 3 or 4 years earlier. These funds generally raise money on a 3 to 4 year cycle. Their prior fund went through this exact process. It was initial review of many different opportunities. At that point, we did not, in our infrastructure portfolio, have a very extensive holdings in digital infrastructure, data centers, things like that, and we felt like it would be a good area to get involved. And we made an allocation to that fund, but went through this whole process. I won't repeat everything, but we got a consultant that we looked at several digital-oriented infrastructure funds. We felt like Digital Bridge was the horse we wanted to pick, and went through and made a commitment to their fund. On their last fund, in the last couple years, they came through same way. The differences are we're deploying a little bit less money into infrastructure than we were 4 years ago. We were building up the portfolio, and in contrast to 4 years ago, we now have some good data center exposure. And there were also questions about some changes at the firm and things I won't go into necessarily. I would probably need our infrastructure PM to do it in depth, but we passed on the last fund, but they showed us a co-investment that went in the last fund that we liked, and we made a commitment to an individual portfolio company that is in their most recent fund, and it went through this process to make that co-investment. And so we didn't want the fund, but we wanted an individual company.
Okay, so just
Senator Steadman,
if I could. So and this, Mr. Mitchell, you probably should answer this question. The process, if you were to have legal counsel look at that particular investment or a investment, and what kind of costs would be expected to be incurred by the permanent fund to have a review?
Through the
in
chair.
Ballpark. This isn't like in the pennies, but in concept and ballpark range.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Steadman, we have attorneys on retainer, so we have a general counsel in-house, and then he allocates works to specific expertise-oriented law firms based on asset class and needs of the corporation, and for review of a potential deployment to a general partnership, a private equity or private income infrastructure deployment, it would be somewhere in that range of like $20,000 to $40,000 for that legal review. You're talking about attorneys that are very high caliber, you know, $1,000+ an hour type attorneys.
Okay, $20,000 to $40,000. I think, Mr. Chairman, we should remember that numeric. Just at some point, we're going to have another discussion on this. Just for the record, I don't have. I got some serious concern what went on with the Department of Revenue and the ex-commissioner. There's no doubt about that. That's no secret. I don't have the concern with the permanent funds holding a Digital Bridge, per se, and the process they went through. They're two different complete issues. So I just don't want anybody to, you know, assume that there's a direct correlation in how things are managed with that. And I've talked with Mr. Mitchell about this, so I knew roughly how he was going to answer that question. That's why I asked him, not Mr. Not his chief investment officer. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that one particular investment, can you give us a sense of your time horizon on that one, ballpark?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, these private funds generally are 12-year life. So I think we probably have 8 years remaining on the fund we invested in, and similar on the company we invested, plus maybe 2 years. So we'll be in business with DigitalBridge for the next 10 years at a minimum, I think.
Thank Senator Keel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Please proceed.
Senator Stegman.
Just a real quick follow-up. Just the point, the permanent funds in perpetuity, and we know what the draw is. It's 5% a year, and we sit down and talk about this every year in the asset allocation. It's a whole different ballgame when we're dealing with the Constitutional Budget Reserve, which looks to be having a high probability of significant capital draws, the $200 to $400 or $500 million a year. There's been proposals put in by the governor of $1.5 billion a year on a $3 billion account. So that's a much shorter life than the perpetuity life of the permanent fund and the liquidity needs. Just thought I'd put that on the table.
Thank you, Senator Stegman. Please proceed.
Okay, I have a few, my remaining slides get into statutory net income and unrealized gains. And this page shows the history of statutory net income. And statutory net income is what fills up the earnings reserve account every year, and it's realized income. In contrast to a stock goes up, but we don't sell the stock, that's not realized income. Realized income is interest payments on bonds we hold, rental income on real estate we own, dividends on stocks, and then when we exit, and when we sell a stock or we sell a private equity holding, the gain goes to statutory net income. And statutory net income is an important number because it fills up the earnings reserve and provides money that's available. And I think it's helpful just to look at the history just to see how lumpy this number is. So in 2009, there was a negative over $2 billion statutory net income. We had a very high in 2018 statutory net income because of two very large private investments we sold that were very large and so booked like multi-billion dollar gains. In 2021, there was a real strong stock market and we kept rebalancing back to target, so selling stocks when it went over our target, and that just led to, coupled with a few other things, but mostly that led to an $8 billion year. And then the white lines to the right are Callan's forecasts for what the fund's statutory net income will be going forward. And it's an annual statutory net income that we've only achieved on a couple occasions, but is based on assumptions, and all forecasts are, you know, could go different ways. But I'm just pointing out the history is a lot lumpier than the forecast. And I'm going to get into what drives statutory net income and how to think about it here on this page. So we have a number that is pretty bankable, which is I'm calling baseline statutory net income. That's our dividend income, interest payments on bonds, and rental payments on our real estate properties. And so we did $2 billion last year in like really recurring statutory net income. If you go back to this page, the forecast is $5 billion a year and growing of statutory net income starting in 27. The 26 number is higher because we've had a big statutory net income first half of the year, so they're forecasting 6 this year and then 5 and growing next year. So that number of, you know, 5 plus billion, the majority of it comes from booking gains on investments, which are much less recurring in nature. And to think about how to forecast how we're going to book gains on investments, and I'll also point out we don't manage this at all. Like, we just manage the allocations versus the benchmarks and the portfolio risk. I've been at the fund for 13 years. There's never once in my time been a decision that's been driven by we need to book a gain. Like, it has never occurred. So I'm just explaining how we would look at it, but I'm not implying that this is what we do look at when we manage the portfolio. If you look at the portfolio today, there's $17 billion of unrealized gains portfolio-wide as of the end of December. And when we've looked at the numbers in the past, on average, we churn about 25% of our unrealized gains in a given year, but there's wide spectrum. There have been years that it's been 10%, and there's years it's been 50%. But when we model it going forward, we assume 25% because that's been the average. And that's how you get to a $5 to $6 billion statutory net income, is it if you churn 25% of a $16, $17 billion number, you get about $4 billion of statutory net income. You add that to the baseline of two, and you're at six. On that table on the right there, I'm just indicating the sensitivity to the stock market. So if the stock market goes down 25%, the 17 becomes 10, the far left column. So if you're churning 25% of your unrealized gains then, well, now you're down at $2.5 billion. And the reality is a little worse than that, because if you're just looking at the stock market going down, and you look at that first row, a 25% decline in the stock market would wipe out all our unrealized gains in our public equity asset class. So at that point, any rebalancing of equities stops generating statutory net income. And most of our unrealized gains at that point would be in our private portfolio, the biggest being private equity at 4.6. And that's really outside our control. That's when private equity firms decide to take companies public or sell them. And we, when every dollar that occurs sends statutory net income our way, in a down stock market, that would dry up a bit. So that's, that dynamic is what leads to years like 02, 03, or 09, where you have like really weak statutory net income, is that a decline in the stock market wipes out unrealized gains. And you could even be in a situation, like in 08, the stock market went down 50%, so you'd actually have $5 billion of unrealized losses, and then every time we trade stocks, we're spitting out negative statutory net income. So I just wanted to share that, because it's a complicated situation, and in a bear market, it has difficult implications for statutory net income, which we all rely on to fill up the ERA.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Frampton, some of these numbers probably move some with bull and bear markets, right? I mean, we don't book a trade in income from private equity until there's a sale, but as you mentioned, the private equity deals, I think you said, dry up some in a bear market. So likely, if we were to try and sell something, you're going to get a little less from it, right?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that's exactly correct. It's easier to calculate the impact on public equities, but private equity exits absolutely dry up. And we could analyze that, and we do when we model different scenarios, but directionally what you're saying is absolutely correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It would be helpful to get, we don't need it, you know, to the dollar, but some sense of what those correlations are expected to be, because this chart sort of implies that the only thing that's volatile is stocks, and I don't know that's really the implication we mean to convey.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. Just curious, with some of these investments we're doing that become, you know, highly evaluated over time, they grow like crazy, and then maybe the dynamics are such we want to get out of it, and so we realize those very large gains. And so in those situations, so if you could just confirm for me where that money goes when we realize a very large gain.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Kaufman, we have about 40% of the fund in private assets, and when you have that much in private assets, managing the cash flows is critical. And specifically when we exit a major asset, I mean, it comes into our cash portfolio. And we don't want to hold too much cash, so that day I would reallocate it to stocks and bonds. And so at that instant, you'd be a little overweight to stocks and bonds, and then we're trying to maintain our exposure to our targets on private. So we have investment activity that can be lumpy and exits that can be lumpy. And then we've got elaborate spreadsheets that pace it out and estimate where it's going so that we don't end up in a situation where we've got a lot of cash that we can't, we don't have something that we want to invest it in. But I mean, the bigger, the lumpier the private investment, the more thoughtful we have to be about our cash planning and what other things we're buying, but we put a lot of thought into it. It stays in the fund, I guess is the point, but then we have to figure out where to put it.
Thank you for that. If individual members have additional questions they could ask after the meeting of the employees of the permanent fund, the bells have rung a little over 10 minutes ago and we have joint session. Mr. Mitchell, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry that we weren't more expedient in getting through our slides, but I think there's important information and it's hard to rush. And so we appreciate the committee's time. And if there are additional questions when you peruse the rest of the slide deck, please reach out and we'll answer those.
Okay. We'll stand at ease. Meeting back to order. That concludes the morning session. We have an afternoon session at 1:30. We have three bills on the calendar: Senate Bill 140, the Fire Station Grant Program; Senate Bill 23, Civics Education; SJR 2, a constitutional amendment needed for a veto override. So we will stand in adjournment until 1:30.